Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film.
The hormones are high, the neon is bright. Let's jump in the car and take a drive. If anyone asks, you're listening to Mud on Film. But between you and me... this is Zach on Film, talking American Graffiti.
A long, long time ago.
You should have done it in the Wolfman Jack voice.
Yeah. No, that would have been bad.
So, American Graffiti, a 1973 coming-of-age film. High school friends plus somebody who's been around a little bit. He's kind of like the all right. He's kind of like, all right. That's what he plays. Four friends. This is the last night that they're supposed to be together.
And I say the same age. Yes, they do.
Where two of them are supposed to go off to college in the morning.
Right.
And this is kind of their last night together. And so what are they going to do? They're going to go break up with their girlfriends. They're going to go cruising in cars.
Join a gang.
Try to find hot women in a Corvette. T-Bird. And just have a general night in the city of Modesto, California, set against music of the 1950s and 60s playing throughout.
Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful film.
It was quite enjoyable.
What most people don't realize, maybe they do, is that this is George Lucas.
Yeah.
George Lucas wrote, George Lucas directed, George Lucas produced, George Lucas had a fit over Final Cut.
There's the Coppola produced this.
Yes,
thing?
Francis Ford Coppola. So here's the story of American Graffiti, and I think there's a really important lesson that you can learn from this.
All right.
So George Lucas had just finished THX 1138, and I don't know if you've ever seen THX 1138 Robert Duvall. I think it's Robert Duvall's in that.
I've seen stills.
But it is a wacko, crazy, make-no-sense, futuristic movie that is, you know, supposed to be avant-garde. You can tell that there's a lot of influence from the French New Wave kind of infiltrating this and storytelling, and it's very, very different film. And of course, we talked when we were doing Apocalypse Now that one of the projects that George Lucas was considering doing after THX 1138 was Apocalypse Now, but he shelved it. He didn't think he was right for it. And certainly Francis Ford Coppola wanted a crack at it. Sure. And Lucas just couldn't get anything going. And Coppola told him, look, THX 1138, maybe not your best movie. Maybe what you need to do, and he kind of challenged him, maybe what you need to do is write about something that you know, something that you have a lot of passion about, something from your childhood, something like that, something that you can use to kickstart and get this idea off the ground. And apparently at one point, George Lucas was a gearhead and loved to monkey around with cars and race cars and do those kinds of things. And he remembered growing up in Modesto that one of the big things that you did on a Friday night was go cruising up and down the roads and have all sorts of adventures. So he teamed up with two other writers. I don't have them here in front of me. I want to say Hawk and somebody else. Hoyak and I forget who the other person was.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, you look it up. You're supposed to know all these things.
Yeah.
And so they went to work on this, and they got a rough outline of the story. And Lucas had won an award in Europe, and he was planning on tooling around Europe for about 5 weeks. So he hired this other guy. He got a $10,000 advance to write the script, and he hired somebody else to write the script. And he came back 5 weeks later, and the script was just basically Porky's. You know, it was a teenage sex comedy raunchy kind of stuff going on. And today that would be your Porky's. It would be, oh, there's probably another one.
Porky's would be 30 years ago, by the way.
Right.
Today they don't make these kind of movies anymore.
Gloria Katz and Willard Hook is are the writers. So he came back, and this guy that he had hired just didn't do a very good job. Mm-hmm. He still paid the guy $10,000. Basically, all the money that he was advanced, he gave to this guy and was like, okay, we're done. I'm going to fire you. I'm going to have to work on this myself. So he worked with the other two writers, and they finally cobbled together this story that is a very personal story for George Lucas. Not only is it talking about things that he knew about growing up in Modesto and the cruising scene and all of that stuff, but three of the characters The Richard Dreyfuss character, Lucas compares that to him when he was in college, when he was at USC. Then you've got Toad, who's the geek, and Lucas compares that to himself when he was a freshman in high school and just had a terrible luck with the ladies. Mm-hmm. And then what's the gearhead guy's name? Bob? No, that's
John.
John. John is who he compares himself to when he's this junior senior in high school and monkeying around and wrenching around with cars. And so there's a lot of George Lucas in this movie. And at one point they wanted to make this an East Coast coming of age film set in New York or Boston. And Lucas is like, no, this is, that's a different culture. This movie is all about kids in the West, California kids and things that they do. So throw out your sex comedy, throw out your screwball antics, all this stuff. This is stuff that maybe it's not all based on events from Lucas's life, but certainly things that he remembers. And I think that if you get nothing else from this film, you look at the movie like American Graffiti, which is, I think, listed like in the top 70 films of all time. It's a very personal film. It's a movie that he wrote, that he put a lot of himself into because he drew upon his own memories and his own experiences. And if you look at Kevin Smith, he's done the same thing with Clerks, where write what you have access to, write what you know. So he does Clerks because he has access to a video store and he has access to the convenience store. And those are things that he knows and things that he's dealt with. And so he can shape the movie around these things. And I think for someone like you, Zach, I think that's what you need to do. What are my experiences? How can those influence a work that I might be working on in the future? Mm-hmm. Now, granted, a whole movie about Castle Rock is probably going to be rather boring.
Hey, crazy stuff happens at Castle Rock.
It depends on what you
do. Yeah, I mean, depends on what you're going to do with it. You're right.
Sure.
But if you're sitting there and people who are listening at home are sitting there and going, oh, well, my life hasn't been that great. Well, maybe you need to have some life experiences. Maybe you need to go out and do something so that you have an experience to draw upon that you can use. So that's, I think, the little bit of the background on the story. At one point, because no one would make this film, Francis Ford Coppola came in and said, I will co-produce this picture. Mm-hmm. And because he had just finished The Godfather, studios started paying attention because they were like, oh, we can market this as from the guy who brought you The Godfather. And that's kind of how they were marketing. So Coppola, even though he was kind of seen as kind of even though he was older than Lucas and Spielberg and these other guys, they kind of really looked up to him, and he really kind of helped these younger filmmakers out in getting off the ground and doing some big things. And I don't think without Coppola, I don't think we would have had American Graffiti. And if without American Graffiti, we most certainly would not have had Star Wars. So that's how Coppola ties in to all of this. There's actually another part of the story at the end that we can talk about, which is, I don't know. Where do you want to go next, Zach? What questions do you have or thoughts that you have about this that we can tap into? I mean, this was
you talking about story and stuff?
Anything you want to talk
about? Anything we want to talk about. So what really struck me about American Graffiti as I was watching it was how influential it seemed on teenage stories in the years past. Because I see Toad. Toad stands at the liquor store, and he needs to get alcohol to impress this lady. And that whole scene, to me, is just, it just screamed, and Toad in general just screamed super bad.
Yeah.
And, what's his face? McLovin.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
That whole scene, it just felt like, oh, kid that has no really means of getting alcohol, needs to get it to impress people. And he's doing weird things. And so Toad really felt like McLovin to me.
Yeah. No, I can see a lot of that influence.
Yeah. That movie is very clearly influenced by this one.
Yeah. And so that was a thing that I noticed. I was like, I mean, that's something we've touched on a lot in Zach on Film is let's look at these films of decades past and see how technique-wise they've influenced films in the following years, and story-wise, and how stories put together, and characters, I think, also can be influenced in future works. And I think that was a certain part of American Graffiti. the aesthetic of the film mm-hmm. really I think shown through the film, because I mean there's a lot of neon,
yeah,
a lot of color in the film,
yeah,
while simultaneously being really dark.
Well, and so that's the thing. So they wanted to film in Modesto, and mm-hmm. they filmed in a couple of different locations. I think most of the time they spent filming in Petaluma, California, which a lot of people know today as the home of the Twit Network with mm-hmm. Leo Laporte. But they originally started out filming in, oh, where the crap was it? I know Petaluma was the main town, but they started doing in San Rafael. Mm-hmm. They did one night in San Rafael, and their production got shut down by the city council because the barkeepers were saying, hey, this traffic is keeping patrons from getting to my bar, and we're losing business. So they're just like, I'm sorry, you guys have to leave.
Weird.
And so then they moved to Modesto and Petaluma, just north of San Rafael, to do most of the shooting. Thing was, you're driving, a lot of the stuff is cars driving up and down streets, and you're not doing rear projection. You're not mm-hmm. doing green screen. You're actually getting out there with everything. Well, and you can't be dry. I mean, it's going to look very fake if you have, you know, a 2-ton truck with a 9 bank of 1Ks blasting yeah. light into the dark night. And this yeah. was shot at night. And so they needed to come up with ways to shoot. And so Lucas went to, who was it? Wexler, I think is his name. I want to say his last name is Wexler. Yeah, Wexler is Haskell Wexler is an American cinematographer, and probably one of the more influential cinematographers. He did Heat of the Night and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And he also helped Lucas develop a system to shoot all of these car shots in a very small package, because one of the problems that they had was getting the cars, the cameras mounted onto the cars. And you've taken the, did you ever take intensive video production with me? Did
no,
you take the class where
no.
we mounted the cameras to the cars?
No, I never mounted.
Okay, so
I'm never going to mount.
It's a pain in the butt to mount. Now, sure. Granted, today you've got one little suction cup and a GoPro
yeah.
and you can, you know, put cameras all over your car, but you're talking about a 35 millimeter, camera that you're going to have to carry around. So he yeah. and Wexler came up with this idea that when they're shooting, they open that iris up a lot, and they're using a very fast film. That's why it looks very grainy mm-hmm. In the shots that are the cruising scenes. But then they were able to use two cameras and all the dialogue stuff so that they could shoot very quickly. And it does create a very unique aesthetic when you're using that natural light in that film, and because of the grain, it feels more raw. And
yeah.
a lot of people have compared this to documentary. It's almost like a documentary of
yeah, sure.
the last night of these yeah. friends. Which I think is also very fascinating because it does come off that way.
Yeah.
So you're right. It does have a very interesting aesthetic.
Yeah, it is interesting because if we shot this movie nowadays and you're shooting on like a Red or a Alexia, or if you're mm-hmm. shooting me on like a Canon EOS Cinema or like a 60D or a 5D or something, those cameras are designed to shoot fairly well in low light situations.
Yes.
So you mm-hmm. would get a different aesthetic, and you could with like ribbon lights and stuff, you could really pump
yes.
a lot of light into the cars, and you would get a completely different look.
But see,
to
I
this
don't
film.
But that's the thing, they could have pumped a lot of light into the cars. Now
right.
when you're watching a Bob Falfa, Harrison Ford, mm-hmm. when he's driving in his car, or when John's driving in his car, you can tell they've got lights in the dashboard
yeah.
illuminating their faces, but they're not trying yeah. to light, you know, put a light in the back seat that shows
right.
the upholstery
sure.
of the back seat. Let's just see their faces mm-hmm. and let's leave it at that. Matthew, you want to jump
Which
in on anything?
Which is actually pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Well, and I would say that as someone who has studied film and who has been out of the film and television business for about 15 years, I'm catching about 50% of what you're saying. So I think a lot of the lay people in the audience are just hearing wah, 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 Harrison Ford. But you are making really important points here, because if you look at the way this film feels, not only does it feel like a documentary, it doesn't feel like it's shot on 35 millimeter film.
No, and it was actually, I'm trying to find it here. He used a system called Technoscope, which was mm-hmm. an inexpensive way of shooting 35 millimeter film and using only half of the film frame, which gave the format a resemblance to 16 millimeter. But gave you a widescreen look.
Interesting.
So yeah, it's
it gives you it feels like it could be that, you know, that CinemaScope,
mm-hmm.
but it's not, and it's
right.
it feels kind of like, you know, almost like the film strips
Yes.
You, did you have, mm-hmm. you ever watch those when you were a kid, Steven? Yeah, the film strips, the Disney films that we'd watch in school. Mm-hmm. Which adds to that immediacy. And I think that, you know, visually speaking, half of the reason, and I say this, and I believe that this is true. I'm not, you know, just speaking out my butt. Half of the reason this film feels so immediate and the reason that it's lasted so long is because exactly of that perspective. What they do on this film feels like you're getting that peek into a real person's life.
Yes.
And that's kind of amazing, especially, you know, this is in that 70s period where lots of people were experimenting and the movies were getting, mm-hmm. you know, this came out. Didn't it come out the same year as Bonnie and Clyde?
70. It came out the same year that The Sting came out because it lost Academy Award to The Sting, which we've already talked about. It came out in 70, I want to say 73. But
what year was Bonnie and Clyde?
I want to say 68, something like that.
68. Oh, yeah. So it was earlier.
Yeah.
It was a little bit earlier.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting is this is the first time I've watched it in high definition. Mm-hmm. I've either watched it before on VHS or regular DVD or broadcast television. And so never got to see it in the theater. Of course, I was too young.
Right.
But, well, I remember when this would come out on television,
mm-hmm.
I would be at like my grandparents' house on a summer night and my mom and dad wanted to go out and do something. And so they just dropped me off at my grandparents' house and I'd hang out with them. And I just remember watching this. I must have watched American Graffiti about two or three different times at their house while my mom and dad were out on date night or whatever that they were doing. And I have this really weird memory of it being summertime and windows open and it being very, you know, that kind of quiet time of the night where the neighborhood is quiet and you hear the dogs barking and all of that and the crickets doing their thing. And then watching American Graffiti on my grandparents', you know, 27-inch big console television set and just being amazed by it and being taken by the music and just being taken by everything. And always right at the last minute, right as the Richard Dreyfuss's character is flying away, my parents coming and picking me up and OK, it's time to go home. And I'm always missing out on the, you know, the little placards, the end result of what happened to all the characters. So,
yeah, that's an interesting thing when I think about it, because I watched it today. And it was like 90 degrees out.
So
when you say that you have this vivid memory of you watch this movie and your surroundings almost kind of reflected the mm-hmm. climate that it was in, that's interesting because now that I think about it, this would not be a fun movie to watch in the winter, I don't think.
No,
then you couldn't go and drive with your friends, really, because you're in your bunker because it's freezing.
But again, first time I've seen it in high def, so there's a huge visual difference between the stage stuff like that you see at Mel's Diner and at mm-hmm. and out in front of when they're dealing with the pharaohs, and then this grittier looking street view stuff, and it is a very interesting look. Lots of light, lots of color. It's visually it is very pretty mm-hmm. and shot by Lucas and shot by another guy. They didn't really have formal training, and Wexler came in and showed them how to do some things and different ways to shoot it. But that's about it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. What do you think about the story?
I think the story is interesting. I like the vignette kind of thing where we jump back and forth between like three different storylines, essentially mm-hmm. four mm-hmm. storylines. I like that because I didn't know going into this was like a one night kind of thing. I remembered it vaguely, and then you get it a little bit like, oh, this is just like over one night.
Right.
And so the vignette is an interesting way to tell multiple stories coherently, especially when you have that one single thread kind mm-hmm. of through them. And I think the thread in this was the streets, mm-hmm. the diner, and the radio.
Right.
And so when you put all those together, the story was very enjoyable from that because you kind of see things bouncing around mm-hmm. and get story development in an interesting way, unlike a movie that is one linear story
right.
where you watch one character or multiple characters have an arc. In this, we have to bounce around between characters, and you can delay someone's an arc by mm-hmm. jumping to someone else's story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very interesting because how do you the process of building tension in one story and immediately deflating it almost by jumping to someone else's story or mm-hmm. making the stories cross paths. It's just a very interesting story aspect.
Well, you know, there's an interesting part, you know, where Toad and his girl that he picks up are going to have sex.
Right.
And you cut away to something else. And then it's a long time before you cut back to them finishing up and moving on their way and running into, you know, other people along the way. And it's at that slow part of the night, you know, that 2 a.m., 3 a.m. time period where nothing's really going on. And so it is very interesting that you can cut away to these stories. I think Lucas originally wanted to follow a very repeating pattern of telling the story. So you'd follow character A, then character B, then character C, then character D, then back to A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D. It didn't work out that way in the edit. And certainly when they started putting changes that the studio suggested, it kind of fell apart that way. But you can kind of start to see that pattern start to develop in there. So that's a really good observation there.
The time aspect was interesting to me because you in our part of the country, in our part of the world, DJs, they're off the air at like 11 some nights. Friday nights when I was in junior high and high school, you get the DJ on to maybe midnight, usually about 11. And so when you have Dreyfus's character walk into the DJ station, I'm thinking, oh, it's probably about 11, 1130. And I see a clock on the wall. It says almost 5. I was like, whoa, you guys did something wrong. And then I realized, no, it's actually 5 in the morning and the whole town's still bumping.
There was a time, Zach, before you were born, that radio stations actually did operate 24/7. Now, some smaller towns would actually turn off at midnight.
Weird.
But there would be sometimes, and some people like me and Matthew maybe too, where we would work overnight shifts. So we would work from midnight until 6 a.m.
Oh, no way.
There were
because
a lot of times
you couldn't automate to the computer.
Yeah, we didn't have computer
because there
automated
was no
systems.
Computer.
I think an automated system didn't come into the station I was working at until I want to say like 93-ish, 94-ish maybe. And when that started happening, and it was just like, okay, there's no need for overnight people anymore. But it was not uncommon for me to go into work on Saturday at around 8 o'clock. And because of that time you were still playing Top 40 and the Beatles archive stuff off of a CD, you didn't have anything to do. So they made you clean the offices for 4 hours. But then from midnight to 6 a.m., you were on the air. And so, you know, we were broadcasting that thing. And it's interesting. I was expecting you to say that you would go out and cruise because, you know, apparently when this movie came out, cruising was not a very big deal. But in the Midwest or in the central parts of the United States, I remember in high school, that was the thing to do.
You drove
to Ottawa, 10 miles away, and you drove this circuit up and down, and you talked with people, and you did everything that you see in this movie.
Oh, no, we did that all the time.
Okay, because, again, when I was in college, and this kind of goes into the sound part of this movie, I remember walking from one end of the building to the other end, which was at the street, and here in Hayes, the route used to be, you know where JD's Chicken is?
Yeah.
That used to be the Sonic.
Yep.
That used to be where Sonic is.
Okay.
So you would go from the courthouse, that police parking lot across the street from the Fox. You'd turn around in there. You'd cruise down Main all the way to 8th Street. You'd go down 8th Street to the Sonic Drive-In, and you'd do a loop there.
Okay.
And that was your loop.
Yeah.
And it was like 10 or 15 minutes to do that entire loop. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that was one of the problems that John was complaining about, is that you couldn't go out and cruise.
Yeah.
But I could go out to that front door and open it up and see the kids driving around, and everybody had it on the same station.
Yeah.
And it was really kind of magical because you could sit there and you could hear, either if you pre-recorded something that was playing out, you could hear yourself coming out of all these cars. You could hear the song that you were playing coming out of all these cars, and you could hear it echo and bounce off of the walls of the buildings, off the sides of the buildings, and just kind of echo and fill that entire space. So again, you're talking about a kind of a magical memory where you just have this very diffused kind of sound coming in from all angles and from all places. And everybody's all taking part of that same experience and driving up and down. And I know that sounds I know for some listeners, it may just seem very archaic and it may seem very, quaint and very,
dude,
I don't know.
I did it and it seems archaic.
I don't know, but there's something fun about it.
Oh yeah. In Quinter, there's nothing to do. Ever since I lived there, there's nothing like open past 9, a gas station maybe. Yeah. So you just drove around and drove a loop and we listened to whatever music we wanted to listen to. We got into trouble a lot by playing stupid games in our cars. But that's seriously, that's what we did. There was a loop in Quinter. And we do that all the time. It is weird because we no one. I don't think anyone ever does that in Hayes now.
No, nobody does.
Nobody does now.
No, in fact, they curtail it. I mean, when they started backing off curfews to like, first it was midnight, then it was 11, then it was 10, and I was at like 9, 10 o'clock now is the curfew.
10.
Man, what a rip for kids.
Yeah, well, that blew my mind when I moved to Hayes. Well, like, we have a curfew. It's like, what's a curfew? Like over the whole city?
Yeah. What are you saying, Matthew?
We used to drive the circuit between the 24-hour store and the park, and then you'd come back and forth. But then the entire town would basically, they roll up the streets at 10 o'clock. Those were the only two places you could get into.
Yeah.
But I think it is important to remember that the kids today can be social without having to see one another.
Yeah.
Well, that's true.
I think, they don't have to leave the house. You can go and hang out with your friends on the interweb with the Skype and the chat roulette and all that.
Yeah, and you can definitely get onto the chat, or you can instant message.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, with gas prices the way they are, you're not paying. You know, I remember at a time where, and I've told this story before, I could get $20 for mowing grass. I could take my truck, drive it to Topeka, go to one comic book store, buy a couple of comics, go to another comic book store in Topeka, buy some comics, get on the road, the interstate to Lawrence, go to a comic book store there, buy some comics, fill up my tank with gas and still have enough money for a hamburger, French fries, and a drink and drive home, all on $20.
Nuts.
You can't do that today. No. I mean, you know,
gas, I don't believe.
No, seriously. This was 75
comics
cents a comic.
75 cents.
75
man.
Cents, man. So I could go and I could buy, you know, $5 worth
four
of comics.
Cups.
I could go buy $5 worth of comics, $10 worth of comics. Hamburgers are a buck or less. Gas was 25
gas was
cents a gallon.
Cents.
Well, 89 cents. I remember that in like 95, 96 in Atlanta, 89 cents. We're talking 50 cents a gallon. So I could fill up and drive a long ways and do a lot. And there was that social aspect. You didn't have cell phones. You didn't have, you know, if you wanted to go hang out with the kids, you had to go somewhere where the kids were hanging out. You had to go where your peers were. And that was the park. That was cruising. That was the Dairy Queen. That was the Sonic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was something special about that Matthew, you're right. Something is lost now. There's also a weird thing. There's also a weird thing where kids just don't want to drive anymore.
That's certainly a thing.
Well, and it's not the same experience, and it's not necessarily bad. It's not necessarily lesser, but it's not the same experience driving, because when I bought my first car was this enormous red piece of junk. But it was enormous, and you could fit 19 people in the thing. And, you know, one of my associates just bought herself a brand new car. You can barely fit me in it. So, you know, it is a different experience. It's an entirely different world. And even in the day when we were doing what we were doing, because I'm going to tell you a story, Stephen. I did not watch American Graffiti first. Before I ever watched American Graffiti in the 1980s, I saw The Hollywood Nights.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Have you seen The Hollywood Nights?
Yes.
Which is basically American Graffiti set about a year later.
It's the sex comedy. It's the sex comedy.
Yes, and it is fascinating because I watched The Hollywood Nights first, and then I watched American Graffiti. And, you know, being the cad that I was and the young bounder, I'm like, man, this is just a ripoff of The Hollywood Nights. But even just a few years later, from 73 to 1980?
Yeah.
Not even 10 years later, that experience felt entirely different. And they were telling a story that was entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
By the time that I started actually doing the cruise in 1986, 87, again, it felt entirely different. So I think it's something where the cruising experience is probably gone, with the exception of people who specifically go out in the car clubs here in town. We'll have Saturday night cruising nights, and they'll bring out their, you know, their classic American Graffiti type cars.
Yes.
And do that, but that's mostly people your age and my age and older who grew up doing it.
Yeah. You don't see much of that anymore, which is sad. And again, it depends on where you go.
True.
Jump back to the cruising experience, going out and hearing the radio station echo because everybody was on that. That actually played a key role in developing this world sound that's encompassed in American Graffiti, which is a very unique sound.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't pioneered in American Graffiti, but that's where most people knew it from, because the film that did it first was Orson Welles' A Touch of Evil, but that movie was hardly released, had a limited time, and was shelved.
Okay.
But essentially what happened was that they were wanting to take Wolfman Jack and his program and have that kind of be, as you mentioned before, this backbone throughout the entire movie. But they wanted the sound to not just sound like it was coming from the immediate car speaker in front of where the audience was. They wanted it to echo and bounce and do all these things. So George Lucas hired Walter Murch. Most people know Walter Murch today as an editor, an Academy Award winning film editor for like Cold Mountain and some other things. But originally he was an audio editor.
Yeah.
And he and Lucas came in and they took Wolfman Jack's entire 2-hour long program that runs throughout the movie. And they went to some parking lots in different places. And they basically had a tape deck playing back that show through a loudspeaker.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other end of the court, they had a microphone attached to another recorder, and those two were synced so that they were playing back at a constant speed. And then what would happen is March would sometimes take the microphone and move it closer to that speaker and sometimes farther away. And sometimes Lucas would take the speaker and turn it off axis, left or right or up and down, and bounce it all around. And that's why when you're listening to the songs and the music and everything in there, it has this weird echo and vibe, and it actually sounds like the music is coming from all over the place. And if you've been in an experience like I have where you listen to cars driving by and they're all doing that same thing and it's all bouncing around, it seems very, very real.
Yeah.
Now, when they did it with Touch of Evil, all they did was they just took the speaker and they bounced it off of an alley wall behind the studio and recorded it the same way. But Murch was like, well, how can we move this all around? And the process is called worldizing. Is what it, because it sounds like you're in the world, that the sound is in the world. And it's a cool technique that I have not seen people do. I certainly in a 5.1 surround kind of environment, you can move the sound all around, but I don't really see people do that as much anymore.
Yeah. It adds an interesting, audio aesthetic to the film, which is something, that isn't utilized as much. I mean, there are certainly, well-crafted audio things, and really when you watch the Academy Awards, you talk about sound editing now, it's generally huge big crash sequences, Gravity won sound editing, and not to dismiss Gravity as well sound editing, but the sound editing they're doing is certainly different than what they did in American Graffiti.
They
used it to put people into the world, which again everything does, but it just kind of enhanced the feeling of this time and the era that the story is taking place in. And as a person who didn't grow up there, that is an interesting thing, because that the world of American Graffiti is not in a world I am anyway accustomed to, besides being a teenager and doing weird stuff.
For me, and this is, and some people may get this, I don't know a lot about music, because growing up, my parents usually kept it on the classical radio station, because that's what my dad liked to listen to. So up until about probably 1980 or so, most of my music experience and knowledge was all based on what we know today as classical music, NPR type stuff. So you could, back in the day, you could ask me anything about, you know, the three B's, Brahms, Beethoven, and Bach, and I could boobies, and I could tell you all sorts of things about that, knew it in and out, and could tell just by the first couple of notes who this was, what movement, et cetera. And then I never listened to music of the 70s and 80s that we traditionally know, because then I immediately jumped from classical music into, and probably because of American Graffiti, into, at that time, classic rock. I think today it's called oldies. But then it was, you know, classic rock and roll. And so I was into Johnny B. Goode, and I was into Little Richard. Basically, everybody featured in the American Graffiti soundtrack I knew. And that's what I listened to all through, I don't know, the early 90s probably, is just, classic rock, today's oldies music. So I kind of skipped over all of the 70s and 80s stuff, and only wasn't until, I don't know, probably the early 2000s that I really started paying attention to what was all this music of the 70s. So, you know, I'm still catching up. So when you and Rodrigo are making fun of me because I don't know, you know, who all these new upcoming hip kid bands are, it's because, you know, I'm still stuck in the 90s.
I can't wait until you go through your boy band stage.
Oh boy.
Man, that'll be exciting.
My sister went through that. I'll pass.
You do understand that Zach makes up 50% of those band names to troll you, right?
No, I have never made up a band name to troll anyone, unless it's like,
let's make up band names. We've done
let's make up band names before, but if you ever ask, hey Zach, take a band, we'll see if Amazon has it on vinyl. Never made up a band. All real stuff.
There's a movie soundtrack just recently came out on vinyl. I was really surprised. It's like at Walmart or something, where it's on. They release the soundtrack on vinyl in a special edition. I was like, well, Zach would be interested in that.
Vinyl is a weird thing. There's always this niche group of stuff that's putting out on vinyl. I mean, you have weird bands that are putting stuff out on cassette tapes.
Yeah, I mean, whatever works.
Vinyl's still a thing. It's good.
The music licensing for this movie, people passed on this mostly because they didn't want to deal with the music licensing. Because as George Lucas was writing the script, he would put at the top of every page of the script what song he was thinking about or what song he envisioned playing in this scene. So if it was Green Onions at the top of the screen, there's Green Onions. And no studio would touch it because they're like, the licensing of this music is going to be a nightmare. Mm-hmm. Finally, when Universal said that they would do the movie, they said, okay, here's the way we're going to get around it. We're going to just pay a flat rate per song to the music companies, and that's it. And if you don't like it, then fine. We won't use your song. We'll use something else. And so most people bought into it except for one person, Elvis Presley. And people, when you think of 1962, you're like, well, Elvis should be all over the place. No Elvis music because, what's his name? Colonel Parker?
Colonel Tom Parker?
Yeah. He was like, nope, it's got to be $90,000 a song. And they're like, sorry, we've got a very specific budget of, I think the final budget was like $777,000. $777,777.77. It's
what
like
the heck?
I don't know where that. I don't know if that's true or not. That's but weird. I know that they had budgeted like $790,000 and not a penny more.
Okay.
Because Universal was into because of the success of Easy Rider, studios were like, well, we should have these young kids go out and do really independent films for really low budget and let them have the creative control and then come back and do all this stuff. And they certainly saw that with Lucas. Of course, there was some financial stuff to get the other $250,000. That's why Coppola came on board. But the studio wanted Final Cut, and Lucas didn't want to have any of that. Ugh. They ended up removing four scenes. Lucas is a true—I mean, if you go back and read, Lucas is a huge control freak on this movie specifically. And, again, probably because it was very personal to him. And I think that that's what helped save this movie, because if it had turned into Hollywood Nights, Matthew's fine movie. But if this movie had turned into Hollywood Nights, it would not have been
it would not be memorable.
Yeah. And that was something I was aware of while watching this, thinking, especially when I made the comparison to Superbad at one point. I was like, a teenage coming of age movie now would not do these things. One, because that's not the kind of time we live in anymore, and times have changed.
Yeah, but you go to the house party, though.
Sure. But what I'm saying is
that's a different movie. That's kid and play.
This movie, while there is allusions to sex and sex talked about, there's no nudity in the film. There's very little adult language. But in today's coming of age movies, that certainly are prevalent themes throughout. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm not saying that's bad or it should be done one another. It's just interesting how our coming of age movies have developed over the decades. I mean, this is not The Breakfast Club.
Mm-hmm.
They're totally different, and the characters are different. Yeah. And what's a coming age movie now? I guess Superbad, kind of.
Yeah, Superbad is coming
Superbad
of age.
American Pie is
a coming of age. It's a little bit older, but all of those kinds of things.
Yeah,
Superbad is maybe the most.
I'm trying
to think of a coming of age. Let's just look it up here on the IMDb.
Coming of age movie. Maybe you're something with Michael Cera in it.
Oh, what's the one that's coming out this weekend?
Neighbors,
isn't
those everyone's in college in that movie and married people. Michael Cera, what has he done recently?
Juno. That's even old. That's even older than Superbad.
That's like 2004 or something. I don't know. That's interesting.
Wikipedia, you're so crazy.
What do they say?
Harry Potter is a coming of age movie. Bull crap.
Well, it's not in this.
Not in this style.
In the product. Wikipedia is open source, and people have different definitions.
I don't know. That's interesting. Maybe someone else will have an idea in the comments.
HuffPo has like the 25 best coming of age stories.
Well, don't listen to the HuffPo either.
Stand by Me coming of age story.
That's not recent.
It definitely is.
Not recent. Stand by. I'm not saying it's recent.
I'm saying it is a coming of age.
Oh no, I'm fine with that. It's not recent though.
Dazed and Confused.
I thought Stephen was poo-pooing it. Dazed and Confused is American Graffiti circa 1993.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Totally is. That's why I said John was the all right character.
All right. Yeah. Oh, that's right. We already did reference that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ha ha!
Man, I don't know. Maybe coming age means
you your... I am old. Because I'm like, what about that?
There is a new one.
Dead Poets Society.
I have not watched The Perks of Being a Wallflower yet, but that's a coming of age movie. Have you watched that one?
I have. That is a good movie.
Is it a good movie?
I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. Yeah. That would be totally a thing. And I guess I don't know anything about the book. I know that, but The Fault in Our Stars, maybe coming of age story. I have no idea. Perks of Being a Wallflower. Yeah, coming of age story. Nice, nice one.
And it's from this decade.
Yeah,
it is. And it only took us 15 minutes.
It was only like last year, 2 years ago.
So here's, so obviously, you know, Lucas wanted to edit the film himself, but he got, the studio said, no, we're going to make Mother Hubbard come in and edit. Verna Fields come in and edit. She had previously edited Steven Spielberg's Sugarland Express. She would go on to edit basically everything Spielberg would do, including Jaws. She came in and did the first pass. Then Lucas's then wife, Marsha Lucas, did a second pass on it to get it all edited in. They had to take out a couple of things for the studio, but $775,000 what it cost to make opened up in the theaters. And the studios, when they first looked at it, was like, this is a made for TV movie. I mean, there's no way that we're going to release this in theaters. And they were gearing this thing up to be in the theaters. And then a couple of early releases got out and people around the studio started talking, and that started generating a lot of buzz around Hollywood. And the studios were like, okay, hold on just a second. Tell you what we're going to do, George Lucas. We're going to put this in a few theaters here in Los Angeles and a few theaters in New York, and we're just going to run it there. And it blew up big. And then they had to do a wide release, and it became this popular movie. Something like $218 million is what the movie has earned today.
Wow.
One of the most profitable movies of all time, as far as a cost to profit ratio. Less than a million to make, $220 million plus dollars in the back end.
Not bad.
Coppola, when the studios were like, we're going to make this a TV movie, Coppola's like, no, you're not going to make this a TV movie. I will write you a check for the $775,000 and buy it from you outright. Which would have made, if he would have done that, if the studios would have done that, it would have made him an instant $30 million off of that check. And I guess today Coppola still kicks himself for not forcing that issue even further. But the upshot of this was, it was so popular. It was up for a number of awards. It got Lucas instant recognition. Lucas took like $300,000 of his own money that he got paid for the movie and set it aside for the space adventure fantasy that he was going to work on. And because of his popularity from American Graffiti and the money that he made from this, he was then able to go on and start to work on Star Wars as his next project. And of course, we all know where Star Wars went off.
Yeah,
that's right. The Star Wars Holiday Special. Wherein B. Arthur runs a cantina and Lumpy and Itchy celebrate Life Day. The pinnacle of Star Wars trilogy.
I think the thing that you need to take out of all of this, Zach, about American Graffiti is be passionate about what you know and try to write a story about your life experience. And who knows, maybe it'll take you so far as to create the next billion-dollar film industry. In the form of Star Wars.
I wouldn't be upset about that.
It may also launch the careers of people like Richard Dreyfuss, who we would see for years later.
Gosh, did I love him.
It wouldn't launch the career of Ron Howard, but it would move Ron Howard from a child actor to a teen actor.
Mm-hmm.
Harrison Ford, of course, this was his first movie. He turned 30 during the filming of the movie.
I have watched more films with Harrison Ford in it in this series of Zach on Film than I ever knew he was ever. I didn't even know he's in this many movies. How many films have we watched?
I don't pick the movies. They were on the list.
Probably the last four movies
he pops up. I've forgotten that he's in Apocalypse Now.
The Conversation is in this.
Yeah. Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now. I think there's something else.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Harrison Ford's in a little bit of everything.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And we are all
happy.
Cindy Williams was in this. Oh, who could forget Phillips? What's her name?
Mackenzie Phillips.
Mackenzie Phillips.
All at 12 years old.
She had to have one of the producers of the film become her legal guardian during the filming of this movie.
So that she could work. Night. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause she was underage. You couldn't work. She was 12, 13 years old. I think I'm going to say Gary Marshall had to become her guardian. Cause who knows what her dad was doing. Well,
everybody knows what her dad was doing. Her dad was John Phillips.
Mamas and the Papas. And they were touring around.
It is well documented what her dad was doing.
Yes.
He was doing pretty much everything he could get his hands on.
Pretty much.
But yeah. And it's a sad story, but it's interesting to me that in this story where you have teenagers being played by 30-year-old Harrison Ford, that you have a kid who I pictured, you know, I'm like 14, 15, teeny bopper, being played by an actress so young and being played convincingly by an actress who's 12 years old, you know, pulling off seeming 14 or 15, is kind of the point of the character, is to try and seem older than you really are.
Well, and even, I was watching again before Zach came over. Cindy Williams looks super, super young in this. I mean, super young in this.
Yeah.
And
she's like, 23?
I don't remember how old she was in this. She wanted to play a Mackenzie Phillips, role, but she was like, oh, I'll put on braces and do all this. They're like, nope, you're going to be the girlfriend.
Yeah.
What's interesting though,
have you ever watched?
Go ahead. Have I ever watched what?
You ever watch more American Graffiti?
I have, which was just okay. I didn't like it as much. This is, you know,
so it was subtitled Back to the Well, Electric Boogaloo.
Yes, exactly. what's interesting is this movie was so popular that I think it did kind of kick off a resurgence of cruising music of the 50s and 60s. It also kind of led to a TV series that came out in 1974 called Happy Days that featured a young Ron Howard as a kid growing up in the 50s.
Which then spun off Laverne and Shirley.
Yep. And then
featuring a not as young Cindy
Williams. Yep. And Joni Loves Chachi. And then eventually they did
Bonds and the Happy Days Gang, which was the animated adventures of Richie and Malph and Fonz traveling through time with a talking dog and an alien named Cupcake.
Oh, which Mork and Mindy did spin out of Happy Days as well. And then eventually we got to Three's Company with Suzanne Summers as the blonde and the T-Bird.
Everybody in this movie got to be on ABC television.
Everybody in this movie became big names, except maybe Paul LaMatte, who played John Miller. I don't remember what he went on to do.
What else did he play in?
Well, let's take a look.
I feel like I know Paul LaMatte from something.
Let's see. The most recent thing he has done is 2009, a show called Chrome Angels. He also did a movie called The Long Shot in 2004. Beyond Belief Factor Fiction in 2000. American History X was probably the last big thing that he was in.
Oh, that's
in
1998.
He was also in Lonesome Dove and some other stuff. Charles Martin Smith, who played Toad. Man, he's in all sorts of stuff. He's a very recognized
He's been in Fringe,
the TV series. No, that you're thinking of somebody else. Let's see. What's the last big movie that he was in? Left Behind, World at War, Family Law, Ally McBeal, who's an Ally McBeal, Dead Heat, Da Vinci's City Hall, Lucky You. He's a very recognizable face today as an older person.
Oh, yeah. He's one of those big, hey, it's that guys.
Yeah. And then, of course, Mackenzie Phillips went on to do, what's it? This Is It. The hell was that TV show that she was in? in the 80s.
Who?
Mackenzie Phillips.
Who's that?
Mackenzie Phillips.
She was in One Day at a Time.
Yeah, One Day at a Time. That's what I'm thinking of. And of Sidney Williams, Harrison Ford, Wolfman Jack. More and more and more and more and more people.
A lot of people.
Wolfman Jack went on to continue being Wolfman Jack.
Maybe if you got the curves, I got the angles.
Whoa there.
So what are you going to take away from this besides what I told you should take away from this, Zach?
And my awesome Wolfman Jack impersonation.
That was very nice. What I'm going to take away from this is, I like the vignette story.
Yeah, yeah.
And that idea of just building a story through smaller stories that are all interconnected and how to set it up. Because they set it up, you have to set it up so well in the beginning to kind of start branching everyone out to go on their separate paths. Because they all meet up at the same place. And for the first 10 minutes, everyone's in the same locale. And then they all go do their whole thing and they kind of cross paths every once in a while, possibly. Or they kind of just stay the course. And then they all group together at the end for about, 45 seconds. And that was an interesting storytelling aspect, which could probably be flubbed very easily. But I think if you nail it, I think it's very nice.
Okay. Well, hopefully you'll use that somehow, some way, shape,
someday.
Or form. Hopefully soon,
somehow.
Zach.
Somehow.
We've done this whole series, and we want you to be a better filmmaker.
Yeah, me too.
And hopefully American Graffiti has done that for you.
Yeah. Let's give a shout out to our
famous. You have to mention the song.
Yeah, let's shout out to our associate producers right now, who are Ethan Boyd, Cray Bergman, Aaron Barnes, Tony Jacobson, Dominic LaFord, Fisher Millard, Christopher Singer, Ramiro Barrera Palma, Jeffrey Domingo, Jimmy Dunn, Hannah Jones, Douglas Hopkins, Nathan Olson, Steve Jokus. What, I don't know how to pronounce that. Jorge M. Taronji.
Taronji.
Taronji. Dang. Kind of flubbed it up at the end. Thank you, everyone, for donating to Major Spoilers and keep us going week after week. And look at that. We are out of time. We are done here at Zach on Film for this week. Make sure to head over to MajorSpoilers.com where you can find the podcast posting page and give your thoughts about American Graffiti and maybe some of what you think are some recent coming-of-age films in the last decade. Some things that we missed. Give your thoughts about the rest of the episode. While you're there, click on the Amazon.com link and you can buy your own copy of American Graffiti or anything else, anything you'd normally buy on Amazon.com. Click on that link. It's not going to cost you any extra, but just a little bit will come back to us to keep us going more and more and more and giving you more content each and every week. And so next week, we will be looking at the film Amadeus on Zach on Film.